honor and to strengthen resolve, and it had power to heal men and to bring them to safety long after all other resources were exhausted. When the truck finally pulled out and they saw him still standing, they offered their bundles for him to sit on. And he did so, and he nodded and dozed to the hum of the tires on the blacktop, and the rain stopped and the night cleared, and the moon that was already risen raced among the high wires by the highway side like a single silver music note burning in the constant and lavish dark, and the passing fields were rich from the rain with the smell of earth and grain and peppers and the sometime smell of horses. It was midnight when they reached Monclova, and he shook hands with each of the workers and walked around the truck and thanked the driver and nodded to the other two men in the cab, and then watched the small red taillight recede down the street and out toward the highway, leaving him alone in the darkened town. The night was warm, and he slept on a bench in the Alameda and woke with the sun already up and the day's commerce begun. School children in blue uniforms were passing along the walkway. He rose and crossed the street. Women were washing the sidewalks in front of the shops, and vendors were setting up their wares on small stands or tables and surveying the day. He ate a breakfast of coffee and pan dulce at a cafe counter in a side street off the square, and he entered a farmacia and bought a bar of soap and put it in the pocket of his jacket along with his razor and toothbrush, and then set out along the road west. He got a ride to Frontera and another to San Buenaventura. At noon, he bathed in an irrigation ditch, and he shaved and washed and slept, lying on his jacket in the sun while his clothes dried. Downstream was a small wooden cofferdam, and when he woke, there were naked children splashing in the pool there, and he rose and wrapped his jacket about his waist and walked out along the bank where he could sit and watch them. Two girls passed down the bankside path, bearing between them a cloth-covered tub and carrying covered pails in their free hand. They were taking dinner to workers in the field, and they smiled shyly at him sitting there half-naked and so pale of skin with the angry red suture marks laddered across his chest and stomach, quietly smoking, watching the children bathe in the silty ditch water. He walked all afternoon out the dry, hot road toward Cuatro Ciénegas. No one he met passed without speaking. He walked along past fields where men and women were hoeing the earth, and those at work by the roadside would stop and nod to him and say how good the day was, and he agreed with all they said. In the evening he took his supper with workers in their camp, five or six families seated together at a table made of cut poles bound with hemp twine. The table was pitched under a canvas fly, and the evening sun resolved within the space beneath a deep orange light where the seams and stitching passed in shadow over their faces and their clothes as they moved. The girls set out the dishes on little pallets made from the ends of crates that nothing overbalance on the uncertain surface of the table, and an old man at the farthest end of the table prayed for them all. He asked that God remember those who had died, and he asked that the living gathered together here remember that the corn grows by the will of God, and beyond that will there is neither corn nor growing, nor light, nor air, nor rain, nor anything at all save only darkness. Then they ate. They'd have made a bed for him, but he thanked them and walked out in the dark along the road until he came to a grove of trees, and there he slept. In the morning there were sheep in the road. Two trucks carrying field hands were coming along behind the sheep, and he walked out to the road and asked the driver for a ride. The driver nodded him aboard, and he dropped back along the bed of the moving truck and tried to pull himself up. He could not. And when the workers saw his condition, they rose instantly and pulled him aboard. By a series of such rides and much walking, he made his way west through the low mountains beyond Nadadores and down into the Barrial, and took the clay road out of La Madrid, and in the late afternoon entered once more the town of La Vega. He bought a Coca-Cola in the store and stood leaning against the counter while he drank it. Then he drank another. The girl at the counter watched him uncertainly. He was studying a calendar on the wall. He did not know the date within a week, and when he asked her, she didn't know either. He set the second bottle on the counter alongside the first one and walked back out into the mud street and set off afoot up the road toward La Purissima. He'd been gone 7 weeks, and the countryside was changed. The summer passed. He saw almost no one on the road, and he reached the hacienda just after dark. When he knocked at the gerente's door, he could see the family at dinner through the doorway. The woman came to the door, and when she saw him, she went back to get Armando. He came to the door and stood, picking his teeth. No one invited him in. When Antonio came out, they sat under the ramada and smoked. ¿Quién está en la casa? Said John Grady.
La dama.
¿Y el señor Rocha?
En México.
John Grady nodded.
Se fue él y la hija a México, por avión.
He made an airplane motion with one hand.
¿Cuándo regresa?
¿Quién sabe?
They smoked.
¿Tus cosas quedan aquí?
Sí.
Sí. Tu pistola. Todas tus cosas. Y las de tu compadre.
Gracias.
De nada.
They sat. Antonio looked at him.
Yo no sé nada, joven.
Entiendo.
¿En serio?
Está bien. ¿Puedo dormir en la cuadra?
Sí, si no me lo digas.
¿Cómo están las yeguas? Antonio smiled.
Las yeguas, he said.
He brought him his things. The pistol had been unloaded, and the shells were in the mochila, along with his shaving things, his father's old marble hunting knife. He thanked Antonio and walked down to the barn in the dark. The mattress on his bed had been rolled up, and there was no pillow and no bedding. He unrolled the tick and sat and kicked off his boots and stretched out. Some of the horses that were in the stalls had come up when he entered the barn, and he could hear them snuffling and stirring, and he loved to hear them, and he loved to smell them. And then he was asleep. At daylight, the old groom pushed open the door and stood looking in at him. Then he shut the door again. When he had gone, John Grady got up and took his soap and his razor and walked out to the tap at the end of the barn. When he walked up to the house, there were cats coming from the stable and orchard, and cats coming along the high wall or waiting their turn to pass under the worn wood of the gate. Carlos had slaughtered a sheep, and along the dappled floor of the portal, more cats sat, basking in the earliest light falling through the hydrangeas. Carlos, in his apron, looked out from the doorway of the keep at the end of the portal. John Grady wished him a good morning, and he nodded gravely and withdrew. Maria did not seem surprised to see him. She gave him his breakfast, and he watched her, and he listened as she spoke by rote. The señorita would not be up for another hour. A car was coming for her at 10. She would be gone all day, visiting at the Quinta Margarita. She would return before dark. She did not like to travel the roads at night. Perhaps she could see him before he left. John Grady sat, drinking his coffee. He asked her for a cigarette, and she brought her pack of El Toros from the window above the sink and put them on the table for him. She neither asked where he'd been, nor how things had been with him, but when he rose to go, she put her hand on his shoulder and poured more coffee into his cup.
Puedes esperar aquí, she said. Se levantará pronto.
He waited. Carlos came in and put his knives in the sink, and went out again. At 7 o'clock she went out with the breakfast tray, and when she returned she told him that he was invited to come to the house at 10 that evening, that the señorita would see him then. He rose to go.
Quisiera un caballo, he said.
Caballo?
Sí, por el día no más.
Momentito, she said. When she returned she nodded.
Tienes tu caballo. Espérate un momento, siéntate.
He waited while she fixed him a lunch and wrapped it in a paper and tied it with string and handed it to him.
Gracias, he said. De nada.
She took the cigarettes and the matches from the table and handed them to him. He tried to read in her countenance any disposition of the mistress so recently visited that might reflect upon his case. In all that he saw, he hoped to be wrong. She pushed the cigarettes at him.
Ándale, pues, she said. There were new mares in some of the stalls, and as he passed through the barn, he stopped to look them over. In the saddle room, he pulled on the light and got a blanket and the bridle he'd always used, and he pulled down what looked to be the best of the half-dozen saddles from the rack and looked it over and blew the dust from it and checked the straps and slung it over his shoulder by the horn and walked out and up to the corral. The stallion, when it saw him coming, began to trot. He stood at the gate and watched it. It passed with its head canted and its eyes rolling and its nostrils siphoning the morning air, and then it recognized him and turned and came to him. And he pushed open the gate, and the horse whinnied and tossed its head and snorted and pushed its long, sleek nose against his chest. When he went past the bunkhouse, Morales was sitting out under the ramada peeling onions. He waved idly with his knife and called out. John Grady called back his thanks to the old man before he realized that the old man had not said that he was glad to see him, but that the horse was. He waved again and touched up the horse, and they went stamping and skittering as if the horse could find no gate within its repertoire to suit the day, until he rode him through the gate and out of view of house and barn and cook, and slapped the polished flank trembling under him, and they went on at a flat, hard gallop up the Cienega Road. He rode among the horses on the mesa, and he walked them up out of the swales and cedar brakes where they'd gone to hide, and he trotted the stallion along the grassy rims for the wind to cool him. He rode up buzzards out of a draw where they'd been feeding on a dead colt, and he sat the horse and looked down at the poor form stretched in the tainted grass, eyeless and naked. Noon he sat with his boots dangling over the rimrock, and ate the cold chicken and bread she'd fixed for him while the staked horse grazed. The country rolled away to the west through broken light and shadow, and the distant summer storms 100 miles down country to where the Cordilleras rose and sank in the haze, in a frail last shimmering restraint alike of the earth and the eye beholding it. He smoked a cigarette and then pushed in the crown of his hat with his fist and put a rock in it and lay back in the grass and put the weighted hat over his face. He thought what sort of dream might bring him luck. He saw her riding with her back so straight and the black hat set level on her head and her hair loose and the way she turned with her shoulders and the way she smiled and her eyes. He thought of Blevins. He thought of his face and his eyes when he pressed his last effects upon him. He dreamt of him one night in Saltillo, and Blevins came to sit beside him, and they talked of what it was like to be dead, and Blevins said it was like nothing at all, and he believed him. He thought perhaps if he dreamt of him enough, he'd go away forever and be dead among his kind, and the grass scissored in the wind at his ear. And he fell asleep and dreamt of nothing at all. As he rode down through the parkland in the evening, the cattle kept moving out of the trees before him where they'd gone to shade up in the day. He rode through a grove of apple trees, gone wild and brambly, and he picked an apple as he rode and bit into it, and it was hard and green and bitter. He walked the horse through the grass, looking for apples on the ground, but the cattle had eaten them all. He rode past the ruins of an old cabin. The lintel was gone from the door, and he walked the horse inside. The vigas were partly down, and hunters or herdsmen had built fires in the floor. An old calfhide was nailed to one wall, and there was no glass to the windows, for the frames and sash were long since burned for firewood. There was a strange air to the place, as of some site where life had not succeeded. The horse liked nothing about it, and he dabbed the reins against its neck and touched it with the heel of his boot, and they turned carefully in the room and went out and rode down through the orchard and out past the marshlands toward the road. Doves called in the whiny light. He tacked and quartered the horse to keep it from treading constantly in its own shadow, for it seemed uneasy doing so. He washed at the spigot in the corral and put on his other shirt and wiped the dust from his boots and walked up to the bunkhouse. It was already dark. The vaqueros had finished their meal and were sitting out under the ramada, smoking. "Buenas noches," he said.
"Eres tú, Juan?"
"Claro." There was a moment of silence. Then someone said,
"Estás bienvenido aquí."
"Gracias," he said. He sat and smoked with them and told them all that had happened. They were concerned about Rawlins, more a friend to them than he. They were saddened that he was not coming back, but they said that a man leaves much when he leaves his own country. They said that it was no accident of circumstance that a man be born in a certain country and not some other. And they said that the weathers and seasons that form a land form also the inner fortunes of men in their generations and are passed on to their children and are not so easily come by otherwise. They spoke of the cattle and the horses and the young wild mares in their season and of a wedding in La Vega and a death at Bibora. No one spoke of the patron or of the dueña. No one spoke of the girl. In the end he wished them a good night and walked back down to the barn and lay on the cot, but he had no way to tell the time, and he rose and walked up to the house and knocked at the kitchen door. He waited and knocked again. When Maria opened the door to let him in, he knew that Carlos had just left the room. She looked at the clock on the wall over the sink.
"¿Ya comiste?" she said.
"No."
"Siéntate. Y tiempo."
He sat at the table, and she made a plate for him of roast mutton with adobada sauce, and put it to warm in the oven, and in a few minutes brought it to him with a cup of coffee. She finished washing the dishes at the sink, and a little before 10 she dried her hands on her apron and went out. When she came back, she stood in the door. He rose.
"Está en la sala," she said.
"Gracias." He went out down the hall to the parlor. She was standing almost formally, and she was dressed with an elegance chilling to him. She came across the room and sat and nodded at the chair opposite.
"Sit down, please."
He walked slowly across the patterned carpet and sat. Behind her on the wall hung a large tapestry that portrayed a meeting in some vanished landscape between two horsemen on a road. Above the double doors leading into the library, the mounted head of a fighting bull with one ear missing.
"Hector said that you would not come here. I assured him he was wrong."
"When is he coming back?"
"He will not be back for some time. In any event, he will not see you."
"I think I'm owed an explanation."
"I think the accounts have been settled quite in your favor. You've been a great disappointment to my nephew, and a considerable expense to me."
"No offense, ma'am, but I've been some inconvenienced myself."
"The officers were here once before, you know. My nephew sent them away until he was able to have an investigation performed. He was quite confident that the facts were otherwise. Quite confident."
"Why didn't he say something to me?"
"He'd given his word to the Commandante, otherwise you would have been taken away at once. He wished to have his own investigation performed. I think you can understand that the Commandante would be reluctant to notify people prior to arresting them."
"I should have been let to tell my side of it."
"You had already lied to him twice. Why should he not assume you would do so a third time?"
"I never lied to him."
"The affair of the stolen horse was known here even before you arrived. The thieves were known to be Americans. When he questioned you about this, you denied everything. Some months later, your friend returned to the town of Encantada and committed murder, the victim an officer of the state. No one can dispute these facts."
"When is he coming back?"
"He won't see you."
"You think I'm a criminal?"
"I'm prepared to believe that certain circumstances must have conspired against you. But what is done cannot be undone."
"Why did you buy me out of prison?"
"I think you know why." Because of Alejandra? Yes. And what did she have to give in return? I think you know that also. That she won't see me again. Yes. He leaned back in the chair and stared past her at the wall, at the tapestry, at a blue ornamental vase on a sideboard of figured walnut.
I can scarcely count on my two hands the number of women in this family who have suffered disastrous love affairs with men of disreputable character. Of course, the times enabled some of these men to style themselves revolutionaries. My sister Matilda was widowed twice by the age of 21, both husbands shot. That sort of thing. Bigamists. One does not like to entertain the notion of tainted blood, a family curse. But no, she will not see you.
You took advantage of her. I was pleased to be in a bargaining position at all. Don't ask me to thank you. I shan't.
You didn't have the right. You should have left me there.
You would have died.
Then I'd have died.
They sat in silence. The hall clock ticked.
We're willing that you should have a horse. I'll trust Antonio to supervise the selection. Have you any money?
He looked at her.
I'd have thought maybe the disappointments in your own life might have made you more sympathetic to other people.
You would have thought wrongly.
I guess so.
It is not my experience that life's difficulties make people more charitable.
I guess it depends on the people. You think you know something of my life? An old woman whose past perhaps has left her bitter, jealous of the happiness of others. It is an ordinary story, but it is not mine. I put forward your cause even in the teeth of the most outrageous tantrums on the part of Alejandra's mother, whom mercifully you have never met. Does that surprise you?
Yes.
Yes. Were she more civil, perhaps I'd have been less of an advocate. I am not a society person. The societies to which I have been exposed seem to me largely machines for the suppression of women. Society is very important in Mexico, where women do not even have the vote. In Mexico they are mad for society and for politics, and very bad at both. My family are considered gachupines here. But the madness of the Spaniard is not so different from the madness of the Creole. The political tragedy in Spain was rehearsed in full dress 20 years earlier on Mexican soil, for those with eyes to see. Nothing was the same, and yet everything. In the Spaniard's heart is a great yearning for freedom, but only his own. A great love of truth and honor in all its forms, but not in its substance, and a deep conviction that nothing can be proven except that it be made to bleed. Virgins, bulls, men, ultimately God himself. When I look at my grandniece, I see a child, and yet I know very well who and what I was at her age. In a different life I could have been a soldadera. Perhaps she too. And I will never know what her life is. If there is a pattern there, it will not shape itself to anything these eyes can recognize, because the question for me was always whether that shape we see in our lives was there from the beginning, or whether these random events are only called a pattern after the fact, because otherwise we are nothing. Do you believe in fate?
Yes, ma'am, I guess I do.
My father had a great sense of the connectedness of things. I'm not sure I share it. He claimed that the responsibility for a decision could never be abandoned to a blind agency, but could only be relegated to human decisions more and more remote from their consequences. The example he gave was of a tossed coin that was at one time a slug in a mint, and of the coiner
who took that slug from the tray and placed it in the die in one of two ways, and from whose act all else followed, cara y cruz, no matter through whatever turnings nor how many of them, till our turn comes at last, and our turn passes. She smiled, thinly, briefly.
It's a foolish argument.
But that anonymous small person at his workbench has remained with me. I think if it were fate that ruled our houses, it could perhaps be flattered or reasoned with. But the coiner cannot. Peering with his poor eyes through dingy glasses at the blind tablets of metal before him, making his selection, perhaps hesitating a moment, while the fates of what unknown worlds to come hang in the balance. My father must have seen in this parable the accessibility of the origins of things, but I see nothing of the kind. For me, the world has always been more of a puppet show. But when one looks behind the curtain and traces the strings upward, he finds they terminate in the hands of yet other puppets, themselves with their own strings, which trace upward in turn, and so on. In my own life I saw these strings, whose origins were endless, enact the deaths of great men in violence and madness, enact the ruin of a nation. I will tell you how Mexico was, how it was, and how it will be again. You will see that those things which disposed me in your favor were the very things which led me to decide against you in the end. When I was a girl, the poverty in this country was very terrible. What you see today cannot even suggest it. And I was very affected by this. In the towns there were tiendas, which rented clothes to the peasants when they would come to market. Because they had no clothes of their own, and they would rent them for the day and return home at night in their blankets and rags. They had nothing. Every centavo they could scrape together went for funerals. The average family owned nothing machine-made except for a kitchen knife. Nothing. Not a pin, or a plate, or a pot, or a button. Nothing. Ever. In the towns you'd see them trying to sell things which had no value. A bolt fallen from a truck picked up in the road, or some worn-out part of a machine that no one could even know the use of. Such things as that, pathetic things. They believed that someone must be looking for these things and would know how to value these things if only that person could be found. It was a faith that no disappointment seemed capable of shaking. What else had they? For what other thing would they abandon it? The industrial world was to them a thing unimaginable, and those who inhabited it wholly alien to them. And yet they were not stupid. Never stupid. You could see it in the children. Their intelligence was frightening. And they had a freedom which we envied. There were so few restraints upon them, so few expectations. Then at the age of 11 or 12 they would cease being children. They lost their childhood overnight, and they had no youth. They became very serious, as if some terrible truth had been visited upon them, some terrible vision. At a certain point in their lives, they were sobered in an instant. And I was puzzled by this, but of course I could not know what it was they saw, what it was they knew. By the time I was 16, I had read many books, and I had become a free thinker. In all cases, I refused to believe in a God who could permit such injustice as I saw in a world of his own making. I was very idealistic, very outspoken. My parents were horrified. Then, in the summer of my 17th year, my life changed forever. In the family of Francisco Madero, there were 13 children, and I had many friends among them. Rafaela was my own age within 3 days, and we were very close. Much more so than with the daughters of Carranza. Teníamos compadrazgo con su familia. You understand? There is no translation. The family had given me my quinceañera, at Rosario. In that same year, Don Evaristo took a group of us to California. All young girls from the haciendas, from Paras and Torreon. He was quite old even then, and I marvel at his courage. But he was a wonderful man. He had served a term as governor of the state. He was very wealthy, and he was very fond of me, and not at all put off by my philosophizing. I loved going to Rosario. In those days there was more social life about the haciendas. Very elaborate parties were given with orchestras and champagne, and often there were European visitors, and these affairs would continue until dawn. To my surprise, I found myself quite popular, and very likely I'd have been cured of my overwrought sensibilities, except for two things. The first of these was the return of the two oldest boys, Francisco and Gustavo. They'd been in school in France for 5 years. Before that, they had studied in the United States, in California, and in Baltimore. When I was again introduced to them, it was to old friends, almost family. Yet my recollection of them was a child's recollection, and I must have been to them something wholly unknown. Francisco, as the eldest son, enjoyed a special place in the house. There was a table under the portal where he held court with his friends. In the fall of that year, I was invited to the house many times, and it was in that house that I first heard the full expression of those things closest to my heart. I began to see how the world must become if I were to live in it. Francisco began to set up schools for the poor children of the district. He dispensed medicines. Later he would feed hundreds of people from his own kitchen. It is not easy to convey the excitement of those times to people today. People were greatly attracted to Francisco. They took pleasure in his company. At that time there was no talk of his entering politics. He was simply trying to implement the ideas he had discovered, to make them work in everyday life. People from Mexico began to come to see him. In every undertaking he was seconded by Gustavo. I'm not sure you can understand what I am telling you. I was 17, and this country to me was like a rare vase being carried about by a child. There was an electricity in the air. Everything seemed possible. I thought that there were thousands like us, like Francisco, like Gustavo. There were not. Finally, in the end, it seemed there were none. Gustavo wore an artificial eye as a result of an accident when he was a young boy. This did not lessen his attractiveness to me. I think perhaps the contrary. Certainly there was no company I preferred to his. He gave me books to read. We talked for hours. He was very practical, much more so than Francisco. He did not share Francisco's taste for the occult. Always he talked of serious things. Then, in the autumn of that year, I went with my father and uncle to a hacienda in San Luis Potosí, and there I suffered the accident to my hand of which I have spoken. To a boy, this would have been an event of consequence. To a girl, it was a devastation. I would not be seen in public. I even imagined I saw a change in my father towards me, that he could not help but view me as something disfigured. I thought it would now be assumed that I could not make a good marriage, and perhaps it was so assumed. There was no longer even a finger on which to place the ring. I was treated with great delicacy, perhaps like a person returned home from an institution. I wished with all my heart that I'd been born among the poor where such things are so much more readily accepted. In this condition, I awaited old age and death. Some months passed. Then one day, just before Christmas, Gustavo came to call on me. I was terrified. I told my sister to beg him to go away. He would not. When my father returned quite late that night, he was rather taken aback to find him seated in the parlour by himself with his hat in his lap. He came to my room to talk to me. I put my hands over my ears. I don't remember what happened, only that Gustavo continued to sit. He passed the night in the parlor like a mozo, here in this house. The next day my father was very angry with me. I will not entertain you with the scene that followed. I'm sure my howls of rage and anguish reached Gustavo's ears. But, of course, I could not oppose my father's will, and in the end I appeared. Rather elegantly dressed, if I remember. I'd learned to affect a handkerchief in my left hand in such a way as to cover my deformity. Gustavo rose and smiled at me. We walked in the garden, in those days rather better tended. He told me of his plans, of his work. He gave me news of Francisco and of Raffaella, of our friends. He treated me no differently than before. He told me how he had lost his eye, and of the cruelty of the children at his school, and he told me things he had never told anyone, not even Francisco, because, he said, that I would understand. He talked of those things we had spoken of so often at Rosario, so often and so far into the night. He said that those who have endured some misfortune will always be set apart, but that it is just that misfortune which is their gift and which is their strength, and that they must make their way back into the common enterprise of man, for without they do so, it cannot go forward, and they themselves will wither in bitterness. He said these things to me with great earnestness and great gentleness, and in the light from the portal I could see that he was crying, and I knew that it was my soul he wept for. I had never been esteemed in this way. To have a man place himself in such a position, I did not know what to say. That night I thought long and not without despair about what must become of me. I wanted very much to be a person of value, and I had to ask myself how this could be possible if there were not something like a soul or like a spirit that is in the life of a person and which could endure any misfortune or disfigurement and yet be no less for it. If one were to be a person of value, that value could not be a condition subject to the hazards of fortune. It had to be a quality that could not change. No matter what. Long before morning I knew that what I was seeking to discover was a thing I'd always known, that all courage was a form of constancy, that it was always himself that the coward abandoned first. After this all other betrayals came easily. I knew that courage came with less struggle for some than for others, but I believed that anyone who desired it could have it. That the desire was the thing itself. The thing itself. I could think of nothing else of which that was true. So much depends on luck. It was only in later years that I understood what determination it must have taken for Gustavo to speak to me as he did. To come to my father's house in that way, undeterred by any thought of rejection or ridicule. Above all, I understood that his gift to me was not even in the words. The news he brought he could not speak. But it was from that day that I began to love the man who had brought me that news, and though he is dead now close on to 40 years, those feelings have not changed. She took a handkerchief from her sleeve and with it touched the underlid of each eye. She looked up. "Well, you see. Anyway, you are quite patient. The rest of the story is not so difficult to imagine since the facts are known. In the months that followed, my revolutionary spirit was rekindled and the political aspects of Francisco Madero's activities became more manifest. As he came to be taken more seriously, enemies arose, and his name soon reached the ear of the dictator Diaz. Francisco was forced to sell the property he had acquired at Australia in order to finance his undertakings. Before long he was arrested. Later still, he fled to the United States. His determination never wavered, yet in those years few could have foreseen that he would become president of Mexico. When he and Gustavo returned, they returned with guns. The revolution had begun. In the meantime, I was sent to Europe, and in Europe I remained. My father was outspoken in his views concerning the responsibilities of the landed class, but revolution was another matter altogether. He would not bring me home unless I promised to disassociate myself from the Madeiros, and this I would not do. Gustavo and I were never engaged. His letters to me became less frequent. Then they stopped. Finally, I was told that he had married. I did not blame him, then or now. There were months in the revolution when the entire campaign was financed out of his pocket. Every bullet, every crust of bread. When Diaz was at last made to flee, and a free election was held, Francisco became the first president of this republic ever to be placed in office by popular vote. And the last. I will tell you about Mexico. I will tell you what happened to these brave and good and honorable men. By that time I was teaching in London. My sister came to join me, and she stayed with me until the summer. She begged me to return with her, but I would not. I was very proud, very stubborn. I could not forgive my father either for his political blindness or for his treatment of me. Francisco Madero was surrounded by plotters and schemers from his first day in office. His trust in the basic goodness of humankind became his undoing. At one point Gustavo brought General Huerta to him at gunpoint and denounced him as a traitor, but Francisco would not hear of it and reinstated him. Huerta, an assassin, an animal. This was in February of 1913. There was an armed uprising. Huerta, of course, was the secret accomplice. When he felt his position secure, he capitulated to the rebels and led them against the government. Gustavo was arrested, then Francisco and Pino Suarez. Gustavo was turned over to the mob in the courtyard of the Ciudadela. They crowded about him with torches and lanterns. They abused and tormented him, calling him Ojo Parado. When he asked to be spared for the sake of his wife and children, they called him a coward. Him, a coward. They pushed him and struck him. They burned him. When he begged them again to cease, one of them came forward with a pick and pried out his good eye. Then he staggered away, moaning in his darkness, and spoke no more. Someone came forward with a revolver and put it to his head and fired, but the crowd jostled his arm, and the shot tore away his jaw. He collapsed at the feet of the statue of Morelos. Finally, a volley of rifle shots was fired into him. He was pronounced dead. A drunk in the crowd pushed forward and shot him again anyway. They kicked his dead body and spat upon it. One of them pried out his artificial eye, and it was passed among the crowd as a curiosity. They sat in silence. The clock ticked. After a while she looked up at him. So, this was the community of which he spoke, this beautiful boy who had given everything. What happened to Francisco? He and Pino Suarez were driven out behind the penitentiary and shot. It was no test of the cynicism of their murderers to claim that they were shot in attempting to escape. Francisco's mother had sent a telegram to President Taft, asking him to intercede to save her son's life. Sarah delivered it herself to the ambassador at the American embassy. Most probably it was never sent. The family went into exile. They went to Cuba, to the United States, to France. There had always been a rumor that they were of Jewish extraction. Possibly it's true. They were all very intelligent. Certainly there seemed to me at least to be a Jewish destiny, a latter-day diaspora, martyrdom, persecution, exile. Sarah today lives at Colonia Roma. She has her grandchildren. We see one another seldom, yet we share an unspoken sisterhood. That night in the garden here at my father's house, Gustavo said to me that those who have suffered great pain of injury or loss are joined to one another with bonds of a special authority. And so it has proved to be. The closest bonds we will ever know are bonds of grief. The deepest community, one of sorrow. I did not return from Europe until my father died. I regret now that I did not know him better. I think, in many ways, he also was ill-suited to the life he chose, or which chose him. Perhaps we all were. He used to read books on horticulture in this desert. He'd already begun the cultivation of cotton here, and he would have been pleased to see the success it has made. In later years, I came to see how alike were he and Gustavo, who was never meant to be a soldier. I think they did not understand Mexico. Like my father, he hated bloodshed and violence, but perhaps he did not hate it enough. Francisco was the most deluded of all. He was never suited to be president of Mexico. He was hardly even suited to be Mexican. In the end, we all come to be cured of our sentiments. Those whom life does not cure, death will. The world is quite ruthless in selecting between the dream and the reality, even where we will not. Between the wish and the thing, the world lies waiting. I've thought a great deal about my life and about my country. I think there is little that can be truly known. My family has been fortunate. Others were less so, as they are often quick to point out. When I was in school, I studied biology. I learned that in making their experiments, scientists will take some group, bacteria, mice, people, and subject that group to certain conditions. They compare the results with a second group, which has not been disturbed. The second group is called the control group. It is the control group which enables the scientist to gauge the effect of his experiment, to judge the significance of what has occurred. In history, there are no control groups. There is no one to tell us what might have been. We weep over the might have been, but there is no might have been. There never was. It is supposed to be true that those who do not know history are condemned to repeat it. I don't believe knowing can save us. What is constant in history is greed and foolishness, and a love of blood. And this is a thing that even God, who knows all that can be known, seems powerless to change. My father is buried less than 200 meters from where we now sit. I walk out there often, and I talk to him. I talk to him as I could never do in life. He made me an exile in my own country. It was not his intention to do so. When I was born in this house, it was already filled with books in 5 languages, and since I knew that as a woman the world would be largely denied me, I seized upon this other world. I was reading by the time I was 5, and no one ever took a book from my hands, ever. Then my father sent me to 2 of the best schools in Europe. For all his strictness and authority, he proved to be a libertine of the most dangerous sort. You spoke of my disappointments. If such they are, they have only made me reckless. My grandniece is the only future I contemplate, and where she is concerned, I can only put all my chips forward. It may be that the life I desire for her no longer even exists. Yet I know what she does not, that there is nothing to lose. In January, I will be 73 years old. I have known a great many people in that time, and few of them led lives that were satisfactory to them. I would like for my grandniece to have the opportunity to make a very different marriage from the one which her society is bent upon demanding of her. I won't accept a conventional marriage for her. Again, I know what she cannot, that there is nothing to lose. I don't know what sort of world she will live in, and I have no fixed opinions concerning how she should live in it. I only know that if she does not come to value what is true above what is useful, it will make little difference whether she lives at all. And by true I do not mean what is righteous, but merely what is so. You think I have rejected your suit because you are young or without education or from another country, but that is not the case. I was never remiss in poisoning Alejandra's mind against the conceits of the sorts of suitors available to her, and we have both long been willing to entertain the notion of rescue arriving in whatever garb it chose. But I also spoke to you of a certain extravagance in the female blood of this family. Something willful, improvident. Knowing this in her, I should have been more wary where you were concerned. I should have seen you more clearly. Now I do. You won't let me make my case. I know your case. Your case is that certain things happened over which you had no control. It's true? I'm sure it is, but it's no case. I've no sympathy with people to whom things happen. It may be that their luck is bad, but is that to count in their favor? I intend to see her. Am I supposed to be surprised? I'll even give you my permission. Although that seems to be a thing you have never required. She will not break her word to me, you will see.
Yes, ma'am, we will.
She rose and swept her skirt behind her to let it fall, and she held out her hand. He rose and took it in his very briefly, so fine-boned and cool. I'm sorry I shan't see you again. I've been at some pains to tell you about myself because, among other reasons, I think we should know who our enemies are. I've known people to spend their lives nursing a hatred of phantoms, and they were not happy people. I don't hate you. You shall. We'll see. Yes, we'll see what fate has in store for us, won't we? I thought you didn't believe in fate. She waved her hand. It's not so much that I don't believe in it. I don't subscribe to its nomination. If fate is the law, then is fate also subject to that law? At some point we cannot escape naming responsibility. It's in our nature. Sometimes I think we are all like that myopic coiner at his press, taking the blind slugs one by one from the tray, all of us bent so jealously at our work, determined that not even chaos be outside of our own making. In the morning, he walked up to the bunkhouse and ate breakfast with the vaqueros and said goodbye to them. Then he walked down to the Gerentes, and he and Antonia went out to the barn and saddled mounts and rode up through the trap, looking at the greenbroke horses. He knew the one he wanted. When it saw them, it snorted and turned and went trotting. It was Rollins Grouillot, and they got a rope on it and brought it down to the corral, and by noon he had the animal in a half-manageable condition, and he walked it around and left it to cool. The horse had not been ridden in weeks, and it had no cinch marks on it, and it barely knew how to eat grain. He walked down to the house and said goodbye to Maria, and she gave him the lunch she had packed for him and handed him a rose-colored envelope with the La Purissima emblem embossed in the upper left corner. When he got outside, he opened it and took out the money and folded it and put it into his pocket without counting it, and folded the envelope and put it in his shirt pocket. Then he walked out through the pecan trees in front of the house, where Antonio stood waiting with the horses, and they stood for a moment in a wordless abrazo, and then he mounted up into the saddle and turned the horse into the road. He rode through La Vega without dismounting, the horse blowing and rolling its eyes at all it saw. When a truck started up in the street and began to come toward them, the animal moaned in despair and tried to turn, and he sawed it down almost onto its haunches and patted it and talked constantly to it until the vehicle was passed, and then they went on again. Once outside the town, he left the road altogether and set off across the immense and ancient lake bed of the Bolson. He crossed a dry gypsum playa, where the salt crust stove under the horse's hooves like trodden isinglass, and he rode up through white gypsum hills grown with stunted datal, and through a pale bahada crowded with flowers of gypsum like a cave floor uncovered to the light. In the shimmering distance, trees and hakale stood along the slender bights of Greenland, pale and serried and half-fugitive in the clear morning air. The horse had a good natural gait, and as he rode he talked to it, and told it things about the world that were true in his experience, and he told it things he thought could be true, to see how they would sound if they were said. He told the horse why he liked it, and why he'd chosen it to be his horse, and he said that he would allow no harm to come to it. By noon he was riding a farmland road where the acequias carried the water down along the foot-trodden selvedges of the fields, and he stood the horse to water and walked it up and back in the shade of a cottonwood grove to cool it. He shared his lunch with children who came to sit beside him. Some of them had never eaten leavened bread, and they looked to an older boy among them for guidance in the matter. They sat in a row along the edge of the path, five of them, and the sandwich halves of cured ham from the hacienda were passed to left and to right, and they ate with great solemnity. And when the sandwiches were gone, he divided with his knife the fresh-baked tarts of apple and guava.
¿Dónde vive? Said the oldest boy.
He mused on the question. They waited. I once lived at a great hacienda, he told them, but now I have no place to live.
The children's faces studied him with great concern. ¿Puede vivir con nosotros? They said. And he thanked them, and he told them that he had a novia who was in another town, and that he was riding to her to ask her to be his wife. ¿Es bonita su novia? They asked. And he told them that she was very beautiful, and that she had blue eyes, which they could scarcely believe. But he told them also that her father was a rich hacendado, while he himself was very poor, and they heard this in silence and were greatly cast down at his prospects. The older of the girls said that if his novia truly loved him, she would marry him no matter what, but the boy was not so encouraging, and he said that even in families of the rich, a girl could not go against the wishes of her father. The girl said that the grandmother must be consulted, because she was very important in these matters, and that he must take her presence and try to win her to his side, for without her help little could be expected. She said that all the world knew this to be true. John Grady nodded at the wisdom of this, but he said that he had already given offense where the grandmother was concerned, and could not depend upon her assistance, and at this several of the children ceased to eat and stared at the earth before them. Es un problema, said the boy.
De acuerdo.
One of the younger girls leaned forward. ¿Qué ofensa le dio a la abuelita? She said.
Es una historia larga, he said.
¿Y tiempo? They said.
He smiled and looked at them, and as there was indeed time, he told them all that had happened. He told them how they had come from another country, two young horsemen riding their horses, and that they had met with a third who had no money, nor food to eat, nor scarcely clothes to cover himself, and that he had come to ride with them and share with them in all they had. This horseman was very young, and he rode a wonderful horse, but among his fears was the fear that God would kill him with lightning. And because of this fear, he lost his horse in the desert. He then told them what had happened concerning the horse, and how they had taken the horse from the village of Encantada, and he told how the boy had gone back to the village of Encantada, and there had killed a man, and that the police had come to the hacienda and arrested him and his friend, and that the grandmother had paid their fine, and then forbidden the novia to see him any more. When he was done, they sat in silence. And finally the girl said that what he must do is bring the boy to the grandmother so that he would tell her that he was the one at fault, and John Grady said that this was not possible because the boy was dead. When the children heard this, they blessed themselves and kissed their fingers. The older boy said that the situation was a difficult one, but that he must find an intercessor to speak on his behalf, because if the grandmother could be made to see that he was not to blame, then she would change her mind. The older girl said that he was forgetting about the problem that the family was rich and he was poor. The boy said that as he had a horse, he could not be